on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
The power that consumers have is the ability to vote with our feet. Players in this space, if you look at the EU's AI Act in draft, it's, you know, providers, those creating, distributors, importers, and many others, they're only as strong as their model flourishes. And so as consumers, we can choose to embrace certain applications that, having educated ourselves, and AI literacy is a responsibility on all of us, I think, going forward, if we're going to interact with this space. If we educate ourselves and we feel as though some of these companies, and I shan't name names, but behind certain language models and other applications are acting irresponsibly, then delete your account. Don't interact with them. Don't give them the commercial impetus to engage with advertisers and third parties and flourish.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. I'm Hadassah Drukart, your host, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Marco Mendola.
Hey, hey, nice to be here.
And on today's episode, we are joined by Rachel Muldoon for an episode about the topic of AI and how we can frame this from a legal perspective, focusing on the AI Act and looking at the practical way forward when we are talking about AI applications and what we should do as individuals and as organizations using and developing AI. Welcome to the show, Rachel. It's absolutely lovely to have you, and we're super excited to talk to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
But before we delve deeper into the topic of this episode, a quick word from our sponsor, BettyBlocks. Are you looking for a way to create solutions that will make legal processes faster, easier, and more efficient? Do you want to offer the best client experience with great digital services? Well, look no further than our sponsor for this episode, BettyBlocks. Rapidly build custom legal tech applications such as legal intake portals, ESG assessments without a single line of code. Start building your own solutions today with BettyBlocks. Now, to kick off the episode, we want to make sure that we do justice to your background and everything that you're doing from a professional point of view. So I want to give you the mic to let you introduce yourself and talk a little bit more about your professional background, Maitland, and everything that's going on.
Of course. I'm a barrister at Maitland Chambers. We're a barrister's chambers based in London's Lincoln's Inn, so just off Chancery Lane. I and my team here practice in the space of, let's call it, technology. That encompasses data, crypto assets, intellectual property implications, general commercial, and of course, AI and all that encompasses. So let's see, my data and technology practice spans about 5 or so years now, all in the commercial space. Initially, it was very much crypto asset based, so looking at the recovery of cryptocurrencies and non-fungible tokens and advising on distributed ledger technology, the metaverse. But increasingly, certainly since the beginning of this year, 2023, I've had more and more inquiries about AI, what it means for businesses in terms of regulation, and also for individuals in terms of data and consumer rights, as we'll discuss later on. And so I'm joined in chambers by Dean Armstrong KC, who's a leading data blockchain barrister, along with Dara Connell as well. Between the three of us, we're ranked for our crypto asset practice. And I'm delighted to say that as of a few weeks ago, I can't quite believe this, but
it's true. I can prove it.
Exactly. I've been shortlisted for Technology, Data and Crypto Junior Barrister of the Year, along with Dara Connell in my chambers and Dean Silk of the Year and Maitland Chambers of the Year in the space. So it's all go, certainly for me, and I'm very fortunate to be practicing in what is a fantastic space at this time in my career.
That's worth a massive congratulations, of course. And we're very happy for you and for Maitland also, and for your colleagues. I think it's very impressive. And what I find is interesting is that you just mentioned what your focus, professional focus, started with, and that it has shifted towards AI and really taken on AI as a main point of focus. We've heard a lot going on about AI. In a previous episode, we have spoken to Uwais Iqbal about what AI is, focusing on specifically the legal sector, but it really counts for all AI applications. So we know what it is. But what are some of the developments that you've seen when you started at Maitland, perhaps? Because I'm assuming that then AI was also already there, but it wasn't as much of a big deal. But it now has become the thing that everybody's talking about. Can you maybe talk about how this technology has taken a place at the main stage, and what it's, you know, what it's capable of, what you're seeing? We mentioned some of the practical cases that are currently ongoing. Can you talk a little bit more about what we're seeing?
Of course. Well, with AI, matters change by the day, let alone the month and the year. It's certainly a trial to keep tabs on all the latest developments. But look, I think we've coexisted with AI models for years. We all know this, from Siri to predictive text to nearly every facet of our lives, AI has been there. But what I see as the distinct change is this mass adoption of the use of large language models like ChatGPT and ChatGPT-4, which has really triggered the public consciousness about how we want to interact with these models and quite how much we want of ourselves to be publicly known, from our image likeness, from our voice and facial recognition software, to how AI might make life more efficient, especially in the workplace, which, as we'll come on to discuss. But with all this innovation, as we saw with the dot-com boom and the dawn of the internet at the turn of the millennium, I think this is very much different, because of the pace of adoption is unprecedented. And with that, regulators and legislators alike need to keep on top of this, but really, as of yesterday, there's no hanging around and waiting and seeing approach. And that's, I've certainly been critical of the UK government's approach here in this jurisdiction, because I think we've seen with the evolution of the internet the harms to consumers, to businesses, and it seems somewhat like Groundhog Day. And certainly, speaking as someone who's practiced in the crypto asset space and been advising clients and bringing claims, particularly to recover stolen crypto assets, I am concerned that we are seeing a car crash in slow motion. And by all means, AI has significant benefits it can bring to society. Of course it does, particularly in the medical field. And in fact, I was in the House of Lords the other day for a discussion with the Physiology Society, looking at how the NHS and other healthcare systems the world over might in time be able to exploit the wonders that AI can bring, particularly with diagnostic tools. But I'm afraid there are some recent news developments that we'll discuss that are really a cause for concern about humans are interacting with these models, and legislators need to take note.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting point that you're making about this, what I at least have come to know as a pacing problem, that regulation just doesn't keep up with the technical developments, whether that is because it actually is a slow process in terms of what it takes to regulate, or whether it is the unwillingness or the lack of ability to actually follow up, because you have this difficult balancing of, on the one hand, the interest of politics, of society, to foster innovation, to ensure that, you know, those developments in the medical field, for instance, can become a reality. But at the same time, yeah, what you mentioned, you have the somewhat negative implications. So it's always difficult to figure out where exactly is that balance. What do you want to do, and when do you want to do it in terms of regulation? So I'm definitely curious to hear your thought about this balance also between innovation and regulation. Before we do that, let's definitely continue the conversation in terms of the impacts that you've seen, positive and mainly negative. That's why it would probably come to court in the first place. What have you been seeing? You mentioned a couple of cases before we started recording.
Yeah, in terms of there's been several class actions that have been brought. So by that, there'll be many listening to this recording who will, of course, know what that is, a class action. But for those who aren't so sure, essentially it's where a group of people say they're affected by something and want to bring a claim, and that can manifest in several ways. For instance, in the UK, we have group legal actions, and there are also representative actions. But in essence, what it is a small group led by a chairwoman or man, essentially, who say we've been affected. And it essentially acts as a test case. So what we've seen, particularly in the US, are many large intellectual property class actions, mostly centered in California, actually. But just to name a few examples, I believe last week there was a complaint, or a claim, as we call it here, filed against Google before the San Francisco Federal Court. A total of 8 individuals, and all of these individuals alleged that Google had, without their consent, scraped data from websites, violating their privacy and intellectual property rights in particular. Now, the allegation is that Google misused this content. But what is the content we're talking about? It might take some of your listeners by surprise that this content was predominantly, or so it's alleged, social media posts, photographs, even those set, or so they say, with certain privacy controls so that they weren't publicly accessible. And information shared across Google platforms, all to chain or train the chatbot, Bard, and other generative AI systems. So this class action in itself is going to be very important to see what happens down the line. Because what we have is we essentially have a group of individuals saying, like all of us, we have spent decades living our lives online, on social media, posting photos, posting content, our thoughts, our deepest, darkest secrets, our life events, marriages, births, condolences. And we all did so in maybe ignorantly, the expectation that that would remain amongst our close-knit friends if we didn't share it publicly. And yet, what is being alleged by this class action is that data is being harvested, and harvested for gain. And it's setting a dangerous precedent because we didn't consent to that sharing, or not explicitly. It may be that in the fullness of time, some of these social media and search engine providers, in fact, say, well, you implicitly consented by way of our terms and conditions. And so it's all going to come down to consent. And as Marco and I have discussed at length, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts as well, AI and data, you cannot divorce the two.
No, definitely not.
It's at the very heart of these models, particularly the large language models. It's at the crux of the training, patterns of data. But we're talking about huge, huge volumes. Without the huge volumes of data, these models simply cannot function. They cannot deliver the outputs. And so that's the harm here, that maybe some cynical people out there, I couldn't possibly say who, maybe that was the plan all along, that we were to be socially engineered into sharing this data so that we could feed these models. Who knows? But that certainly is one class action. There's others that we've seen in recent weeks as well. So the comedian Sarah Silverman and two authors have filed a copyright infringement lawsuit against Meta platforms. I think it's Meta.io and OpenAI. And the allegation there is that, again, they've used content without permission, again, for training of these large language models. And in the lawsuit against Meta, the plaintiffs there allege that it really came to their attention after information was leaked, that in fact this data was being used without permission. The lawsuit also alleges against OpenAI that work has been generated by ChatGPT, again with copyright content. And it's something we're seeing more and more of in terms of large industry challenging the use of AI. And the most recent example I can think of as well is in the film industry. So we've seen actors, in fact, the world over, from Tom Cruise to various others across in Hollywood, follow the calls from the Union from Actors Guild. So that's the Actors Screen Guild in the US, essentially saying that they're encouraging strike action because they want to ensure that any use of artificial intelligence to replicate an actor, their voice, their image, their likeness, is done so with both their consent and also remuneration payment. And it's that tension there as well between, as you say, innovation and protection, because this is those actors' livelihoods, their performances. And while certainly the film industry isn't immune from AI, it's been used by way of CGI, and it's been used by way of anti-aging models, I understand. And there's been some controversy lately about Harrison Ford in the latest Indiana Jones and how he looks somewhat younger all of a sudden. I couldn't possibly comment. But again, that just goes to show that just like all of us, you know, some of these sectors are very much used to interacting with AI. They're familiar. And yet there's a line. And that line also, they say, has been crossed. And so there needs to be those protections. So in fact, it's quite interesting. I'm not entirely sure if this is accurate or not, but I certainly read that Keanu Reeves has specified in his contracts with the studios that there is to be no digital editing of his performance, because it says, essentially, he says it takes the soul out of his performance and his contribution. So it's going to be very interesting to see how litigation develops. Yeah. Certainly for the moment, it's very much intellectual property based. I do wonder if it will stray, and I think it's inevitable, stray more into data protection, consumer rights with time.
So much dense, interesting content from you, Rachel, which is direct experience from your day-to-day study and work. A couple of points I would like to stress out together with you. It goes without saying, we discussed it many times together again, AI and data, they go along together. What I think it's still, at least from my understanding, to be discussed are a couple of points related to this kind of strange relationship. First, the concept of time or timing. And second, strictly related, the importance of narrative. So how you tell the story. So let me elaborate these two points. The first is more about we may potentially give consent, or maybe we don't give consent, and somehow big platforms, big corporations are somehow able to extract the data or to harvest the data, as you said before. But I think more than that, that goes probably beyond consent with AI, is how you tell the story. So how you frame the narrative, because you may have given full consent, but it's how you take the pieces of the puzzles and you combine them together that make a whole story, right? So the word, the human society is based on stories, right? So the way we tell the story about ourselves or groups of people may really, really literally shape the future of our existence without being too metaphysical, literally the way we are structured as a society. So that's a point extremely hard to determine and to define, but so much key that I think we need to pay attention to it. And I would like to know what you think about it. And second, my question is twofold, about timing. It may sound elementary, but another great point is, as humans, we are, if lucky, a span life between 70, 80, 90, if we are lucky. But our concept of time is somehow limited and the pace is somehow regular with some spikes, but somehow regular. With technology, you know better than me, these guys, whatever stays in the web, it's going to be there forever, forever and ever, ever. And with AI, we can only imagine how the kind of forever and ever can be developed. So let me reframe my question, because this is not a question, this is more like a statement. First, what do you think about the importance of how you frame a narrative? And second, have you ever thought about this overlapping of time between the human reality and the potential technology time?
No, absolutely fascinating, Marco. And it's It's been plaguing me every day, and it's a worry. It really is. I think for me, as you say, that the issues are twofold. Firstly, we would all like to think that legal systems the world over would protect our image. And I know that's a very broad term. What do I mean by that? Well, clearly it's the essence of who I am. Artists have been trying to capture that for millennia. Since, you know, our ancestors were using pigment and animal blood and leaving hand imprints on caves, we all want to leave a sense of ourselves in the context that we want to do it. And in some instances, for a small audience, for maybe our families, we want to leave, or maybe a time capsule in a building for general consumption. I absolutely accept the point that context is fundamental. So, for instance, goodness knows, I hope this isn't the case, but whenever we're recorded from now on, our voice on this recording, for instance, or visually recorded, that content, as we know, will be out there for general consumption and will be susceptible to scraping. And who's to say that a deep fake won't be made of any of us? And the danger then is what that deep fake does. What is the subject matter that deep fake is discussing? What is the context in which that deep fake appears? Is it as part of a political rally for a banned party or cause? Is it in association with a big business, maybe a competitor? Is it there to impact a share price? It's context is everything, both subject matter and the whereabouts. And as you say, the space and time of that as well is key, because we all, as a matter of legacy, want to leave a certain mark on this world. And that is an indelible mark, as you say, when it comes to technology. But how can the law step in and protect that? Well, it's very difficult, because here in the UK, we don't have an image right per se to actually protect my likeness. The way in which this has been protected traditionally has been by those who can afford to bring lawsuits, and those who are in the public domain. So it will be celebrities and members of royalty and models and the like. So this is where intellectual property has traditionally stepped in and said, aha, well, you can bring a claim for what we call passing off, which is basically someone's image being used to promote something that essentially you haven't intended to promote. You've been passed off your image or a brand, for instance, as something that it's actually not. So that's been one of the claims. There's also trademark infringement, but again, that's very commercial. Privacy and confidential information protections. Again, we're used to seeing the Prince Harrys of this world and the Prince Charles and in the phone hacking inquiry, A and B rate celebrities, but not your everyday man or woman. And equally with defamation, saying that slanderous statements have been made or libels been published. Again, my concern is that this is all has an air of, well, the law will only protect those who are quote unquote celebrities. And this is something that there's an ongoing litigation at the moment where I'm protecting representing a lady in the public who isn't a celebrity by conventional standards, but she has had her life devastated by the actions of a public authority who've disclosed her private information. So I'm going to be seeking to represent her before the courts in the coming months and who knows, years. But where I see the evolution, as you say, in terms of how contextually our data is used by these models, especially with deepfakes, how I see this developing is in the field of data protection. We keep coming back to it. But certainly Data Protection Act, initially in 1998 and now in the latest iteration, it says that photographs are a form of personal data. Now, I think we'll all agree, photographs being 2D are very analog, but certainly by extension, it's, you know, your facial features, it's your, I would like to think, your voice, your biometrics, all amount to personal data, and in some instances, sensitive personal data. So where that has been used unfairly for an unlawful purpose, then I can see the potential for a data protection class action. And that's something that is going to be fundamental in the future. And we need these decisions made by the courts, by judges, and then enforced in legislation to say, you may not be a celebrity, but members of the public, we acknowledge you. We acknowledge that context is important and that you have the right to be forgotten one way or the other. So it'll be interesting to see how programmers, how the platforms, providers, distributors feature in these and factor in these controls somehow. But it will be a very long battle.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting discussion, and especially the fact that you mentioned data protection could potentially be the way forward. Because what I struggle with is this idea that we see a lot in Europe is regulating every single inch of technology that we are coming across. I mean, we're just at the start of it. What I worry about is that that is just a move to, you know, wipe things under a rug, to just pretend like we're holding on and that we're managing to regulate something that we're not managing to regulate. That's becoming purely a tick the box exercise for businesses in practice. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm also thinking, putting these regulations in place or ensuring that context is provided and that cases can be brought before the court. What worries me there is capacity. You just mentioned the enormous scale of the use of technology, the impact it has not anymore on just celebrities in their lives, but on truly every single person in many different ways to just one person. So capacity is also something that I'm struggling with and trying to understand. How can we actually move forward? You mentioned data protection. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe bring all these points together and think with us what is then the way forward to prevent the tick the box exercise, the lack of capacity, while ensuring that that we have a responsible use of these technologies in the future that is also meaningful depending on the context in which it has its application?
It's a very good question. It's, again, something I've been grappling with while reviewing all the iterations of the draft EU AI Act. And I think the answer has to be, bizarrely, that the only way to control this thing, this unprecedented change that society will be facing, and let's make no mistake, we're not there yet. The technology is being adopted at an unprecedented rate, but the socioeconomic changes that will be prompted by the mass adoption of AI amongst corporates in the corporate world will be devastating in the short term. Jobs will cease to exist, and society will have to take a cold, hard look at how it's going to function going forward and what to do with all of the citizens who ostensibly don't have a means of making a living. And so there's going to be, as we've heard from the Tony Blair Institute and other think tanks, a massive amount of upheaval and social unrest in at least the short term. Then, as we know, there will likely be a new wave of job creation. But again, how, coming back to your point on how do we control this? We don't have capacity. How do we avoid tick boxing? I'm afraid that, to my mind, regulation has to be key. Because it's not just a case of enforcement, it's the threat of enforcement. And by that, I mean, we've seen since the dawn of GDPR and now in the UK GDPR, we've seen massive growth in third-party providers of data compliance measures. Again, I concede that much of that is a tick box exercise. But in tandem with that, we've seen ICO fines that have been some of the largest seen by the corporate world. And we've seen the knock-on effect that data breaches and ICO statements about companies have had on their share price, for instance, and venture capitalist funding. And so all of these things have, at the very least, an impact on making compliance more likely than not, and to achieve the ultimate aim of protecting society and consumers and striking that balance right. So I think when it comes to the UK, what do we have? When it comes to AI, it's a principles-based approach. As we read in the white paper earlier this year from the UK government, it's a pro-innovation approach guided by several principles. which I won't go into because many of your listeners will of course know them. But essentially,
I wouldn't know it. So can you please quickly mention that question?
I'm going to bore you all, but in large part, these principles, I believe, and I'm actually just going to turn to my list because they do escape my mind. We have five key principles, and really in the policy paper, and for those of you who want to read it, it's titled A Pro-Innovation Approach to AI Regulation, and was published on the 29th of March of this year. The five broad principles are safety, security, and robustness. Secondly, appropriate transparency and explainability, funny word. Thirdly, fairness. Fourth, accountability and governance. And fifth, contestability and redress. Now, I think we can all agree that's fairly vague. what does that mean? Okay, well, let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya. It's wonderful, wonderful in principle. But I'm afraid, as a barrister, I don't work in mere principles alone. I work in practice. It's my job to deliver for my clients, either in court or out, advising them. And at the moment, I'm certainly not comfortable advising would-be AI system providers here in the UK, purely on the basis of five broad principles. Now, we all know why the UK government's doing it. They're doing it to encourage business. But on the other hand, as I've put to several leading members of the judiciary in recent weeks, and also MPs and Lords, a principles-based approach without anything more. And what do I mean by the more? The more is a list of prohibited practices. I was at the AI summit with Marco back in June in London. And the consensus there amongst industry leading figures in this space is the only way that AI as a sector is going to earn legitimacy is by having prohibitions on certain practices that are just purely wrong, plain old wrong, too dangerous. So that's what's missing in terms of the more, the prohibitions. And secondly, enforcement. You know, what happens if I do roll out a model that practices one of the prohibited practices or that is just unduly dangerous? Again, there's a perception in the UK on the face of the white paper that the sector is to police itself. Now, we've seen the dangers of that with crypto. That just, it goes without saying. Do we really want the UK to be known as the Wild West for AI? Because I certainly don't. So this is where I see the EU's approach in terms of the Act as fundamentally correct. Okay, the caveat is it's not in final form yet. The latest iteration is certainly an improvement, I would say, on the EU Commission's draft from earlier this year. And I think it does strike that balance as best we can at the moment. Do I think it's perfect? Not at all. Do I think that it will provide a framework for businesses to earn that legitimacy and in turn earn consumer trust and protect us all whilst allowing innovation to flourish? I do. There perhaps could be some improvements in terms of sandboxes and protections for startups.
Yeah.
But we're getting there, is my takeaway. So I think there needs to be, to a point, a checkbox exercise, but there needs to be more than that. There needs to be enforcement powers available, readily available.
I would fully agree with that, and also with that distinction between starters and established companies, because there is always that worry of killing innovation before it has actually come to be born in the first place. So I think that it remains a difficult topic that, like you said, I don't think it can ever be perfect. I think it is the effort that is made to make sure that it is as good as it can be. We've been talking about responsibilities of companies, of corporate, what they should do, how they should prevent irresponsible use of AI. But what keeps coming to my mind is, what is our responsibility as individuals making use of these systems? Where comes our responsibility to know what we are doing online? Where do we play a role as the little puppets, basically, in this entire ecosystem?
Oh, gosh.
Is there a responsibility?
Well, I think, like many things, the power that consumers have is the ability to vote with our feet. So, again, what do I mean by that? Well, players in this space, if you look at the EU's AI Act and draft, it's, you know, providers, those creating, distributors, importers, and many others, they're only as strong as their model flourishes. And so as consumers, we can choose to embrace certain applications that, having, you know, educated ourselves, and AI literacy is a responsibility on all of us, I think, going forward, if we're going to interact with this space. If we educate ourselves and we feel as though some of these companies are acting irresponsibly, then delete your account. Don't interact with them. Don't give them the commercial impetus to engage with advertisers and third parties and flourish. And it's you know, it's not a new idea, but I think that, yes, as consumers, what can we do? We need to educate ourselves. We need to be mindful, and I would say wary, of using the applications in tandem with anything confidential, anything you wouldn't want to be in the public domain. Assume that it will be in the public domain if you upload any information. And if we are dissatisfied and legislators, others, regulators haven't stepped in and taken action, then we take action collectively as consumers and simply walk away, deprive them of their source of income. So again, I think this all comes down to the EU is looking to empower consumers and protect us and to legitimize the industry, and in so doing, gain consumer trust. It's cyclical. It seems to 100%. Me it's a natural evolution, whereas yeah. here it's a complete and utter shambles, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and which, if I just raise a point from something that I finished lately, my thesis project for my master's degree, trust also forms a basis for innovation.
It absolutely.
So the circle is round once this is achieved, or at least responsible innovation. Let's put it that way.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that for me, as I said from the outset, one of the greatest criticisms I've had, or the central criticism for the UK government's white paper, is a pro-innovation, let's say that again, a pro-innovation, principles-based approach without more, without that framework for certainty for businesses as to what they need to achieve, without enforcement dangers. You know, 7% of your last year's global annual turnover, that's a tremendous figure. That, as we said last week, that's tens of billions for the likes of Apple and Google. As a potential maximum fine, should they breach the restrictions under the Act. And in the alternative, what is it, a £40 million fine for those that are a smaller scale. It is going to create a framework that both businesses can adhere to engender trust amongst consumers, which is at the heart of legitimacy. Leaving it up to a principles-based approach without more, without a framework, is only casting doubt amongst the minds of those in the industry as to what they need to achieve, and also leaving consumers in the dark as to what their rights are. Of course, we have consumer rights acts under the regs here in the UK, and there are some statutory protections, but without that assistance of the directive in the EU, one wonders how on earth are you going to be able to bring these claims and prove them?
Definitely. I think there's a lot that we're going to be seeing in the next years for sure. I'd like to think that the EU is forming a nice example and a nice basis for improvement across the globe. Also in the US, we're seeing developments now, but we're going to see. That's a certainty. I think it's also a beautiful way to wrap up the episode. It was really, really a pleasure to speak to you. We're very excited to have you on the show, and the conversation has been phenomenal. I think extremely interesting. I'm very curious to see if our trip to the future will be one that, genuinely, that's going to bring us something good and something useful for the future.
Let's hope so. Thank you for inviting me again.
Of course.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review, as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast.